So I have taken a snapshot of the topics that we said we were really excited about. I have determined that it's impossible for us to cover all of them. And I've determined that it's unlikely we will cover any in great detail. But here is a subset of those that I would really like us to spend at least a little bit of time on. And this may, by the time we start rushing at the end, may be a lightning overview of things like squeezing and some other aspects that I know you're really excited about. So we'll try and go for breadth over depth here to cover as much as we can. But who thinks they can guess what the first thing I'm going to ask you to do is now that we're back together?
Stand up.
Stand up. That's right. So please try and find someone that you haven't spoken with yet. In order to maximize mixing, maybe try moving across the room, not the same part of the room that your current group is going to. Plenty of space down here. If you want to form a new colony. Just move over there. Yeah, it feels like we got some bunching going on over here. All right, everybody, I hope that you have had a productive 5 minutes of introductions with your new team. So be prepared to do this at least once again before the end of our 90 minutes. Well, again, we're going to keep right on mixing. All right, so we're going to dive right back into an overview of some sources. So we finished a brief overview of compact binary coalescences, and I expect Luis will have much more to tell you next week. I also wanted to talk about continuous waves. So this is the jargon that the collaboration uses. This is what we say when we mean waves from something that's emitting something quasi-sinusoidal, so something nearly sinusoidal at about the same frequency. So this can happen, for example, as we said before, if you've got some deformity like a mountain on something like a neutron star. As that neutron star spins, it's going to be producing this time-dependent quadrupole moment. So we can capture that for continuous waves in this fairly simple approximation. So here, the strain amplitude is going to be proportional to the frequency at which the star is spinning. And it's also going to be proportional to this ellipticity factor. So here we define this as equatorial ellipticity, where the z direction is aligned with the spin. So I have a question for you all. As we're thinking about this, given what we know about how gravitational waves are produced. Why do we require equatorial ellipticity as opposed to ellipticity in some arbitrary direction? Why is this required for gravitational wave generation for a spinning neutron star? Let's take a couple minutes and see what we think. I see some confidence in the middle of the room here. He'll be very popular. Yeah. How are you thinking about approaching this question?
I was saying, I guess because there's a quadrupole.
Yes. So maybe another way to frame this would be, would we expect to see a gravitational wave signal if the lump was on the top or the bottom, aligned with the spin?
I guess, no, because it's not moving.
Yeah? It's not moving in a, there's not a lot of time dependence, yes.
Yeah,
okay, very good. I think that's a great explanation. It's interesting because what it means is that whatever the true neutron star equation of state is, it can't support. Yes, exactly. It's very interesting, those upper limits.
So does it mean also there's not? I guess you can still have like some ellipticity, but it's just not, or it's sort of asymmetric.
Yes, so in this approximation, it can have different forms. It doesn't have to be a mountain, so we use the mountain structure because we think that this is compatible with what we know about the way neutron stars are formed, that they've got some kind of crust. So it would be more likely that there was a mountain protrusion versus some kind of a broader asymmetry.
I don't know, like sulfur equation of state or
if it were spinning as fast as it is and it had a soft equation of state, you would expect a deviation, some oblation around the equator, but it would be uniform, at least from our current understanding. So yeah, a strong crust is the best shot that we've got to make some asymmetry. Yeah, great.
See, why are we dividing it by I versus Z? As you see, I think we need two directions because they're rotating very much. Two directions. You probably get two frequencies in two directions, X and Y. But
so we're trying essentially here when we're characterizing the ellipticity is how deformed is it. So IZZ is our reference point. So let's assume that otherwise it's spherical. We could then also take the average of IXX and IXY and achieve the same effect. IZZ is a little bit safer because, just in case, like we were just discussing, there is some kind of crazy magic that's happening on the inside of the neutron star, then we could still capture that if we're normalizing in the Z direction, which we know we're not sensitive to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but IZZ means you are looking at the frequencies. This is the disk, these two objects are merged. Mm-hmm. So basically, am I correct? You are looking at the story of fluctuation.
Yeah, I think I haven't worked through the validity of this approximation for mergers. So I can't.
This is the only picture I
can have. It would be small.
Okay. So yeah, maybe let's think about this as we've got some kind of a great big neutron star and a smaller neutron star. I'm trying to think about if that would break down. Yeah, I think it's tougher than if you think about it in terms of a binary. It's not obvious why you would divide it by IZZ, because you expect the asymmetry to be in the planet orbit. Then maybe we could use our other idea of dividing it by whatever the characteristic average. Let's say maybe we could make some kind of a matrix in the horizontal plane and use that for normalization. That would achieve the same effect. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
duty is very called symmetry. I think I change it to zero, right?
Yes.
That's the reason that we have break.
That's the reason that we have what?
Break is very called symmetry.
Yes. That's right.
Ellipticity. To that IAJ to be non-zero, actually.
Yes, you do. That's exactly right. We require some asymmetry.
Okay.
That's time varying, which is the key here. Yes?
It's a perfect sphere and it is rotating. Mm-hmm. A perfect sphere that's rotating, does that generate gravitational symmetry?
Unfortunately, no.
Because there's no change in the gravitational potential.
That's a great way to think about it. All right, we've had some really good discussion. Gesundheit. Would anyone like to share their thoughts? Why are we thinking that equatorial ellipticity is required? Yes?
You need to break symmetry to get a quadrupole moment.
Right, so we require this asymmetry. What would happen if I put this mountain on the top or the bottom, aligned with the direction of the spin axis?
There should be no gravitational waves.
That's right. And why do we think that is? We seem very certain. And I agree with you, you're very right. No time-varying quadrupole moment, that's exactly right, yes. So we require that time-varying element, which means we need that mountain to be off the axis of spin. Okay, very good.
But one question.
Sure.
What happens if I'm on a reference frame where my inertia tensor is not diagonal? Can I use that formula?
I think the way that I would approach this as an experimentalist is to set myself in the reference frame that's most easy for me to observe.
No, I'm asking because you're forced, as I understand the plot, you're forced to lie on the Z axis.
Not necessarily. So the direction of spin is important because it's going to govern essentially whether or not there's a signal. And we do expect that if the neutron star equation of state can support a crust that can support mountains, that some fraction of the stars are going to have those mountains aligned with spin.
But in principle, the power of these gravitational waves should depend on the angle, because we would have like the maximum in this direction, let's say.
Ah, yes. Right? So okay, I see what you're saying. Yes. That's right. So yes, there's a small amplitude modulation that overall affects. It's not going to change the phase of the signal, but it will have a slight dependence on amplitude for us, the observer. So the question now that I understand you better, thank you for explaining, is the spin angle relative to us, the observer, is going to matter. So we're going to be we're going to get the highest amplitude when we're looking at it from the side as opposed to. Yes. Very nice point. Okay, I have another challenge for you. Are you ready? So I have a series of plots here. So this is gravitational wave frequency at detector. So let's say that there is some neutron star that's spinning, that's out in space. Now at the top plot here, we have the largest amplitude modulation. If we break that down, if we just look at a tiny, tiny part. Oh, sorry, I've mixed up my axes here. So this is essentially a series of insets. And what I want you to notice is that they're on very different timescales. So we have three different insets. I would like you and your team to take a look at the timescales of each one of them and see if you can explain the behavior. So we've got a couple different modulations that are happening and then some kind of an overall trend downward that we're seeing here. So let's see if we can take 3 or 4 minutes and see what we think about these. Why is this happening? Negative to a reference time. So this is, you know, some time that's interesting. Could be my birthday. Could be, it's an arbitrary time. So we could put zero at the left-hand side.
So, I
with how much time do you need to actually say something about the frequency with some confidence, right? Like, I mean, in the first plot, the blue one, there's like 2 days of observation, and you have some frequency, right? But then if you observe for 200 days, oh no, it's time, oh, time slash days, it's okay, so if you observe for 200 days, then the frequency changes a little bit, so you observe something different, like,
do you notice anything interesting about the periods? The periods of the oscillations.
It's getting smaller.
The average frequency in the yellow plot is getting smaller, that's right. But what about the oscillations on top of that trend? Do we notice anything peculiar about the period? So if I look at the period of the orbit, so, for example, in the middle plot, you might notice, or the middle or the bottom plot, that it's about 365 days.
Yeah, oh yeah, mm-hmm. Almost 1 year.
Yep, and then the top one, what's the period of that oscillation in blue? Yes, I would say it's about a day. It's about, so... We can build on those observations. So we got an Earth... orbit and an Earth rotation. Let's see if we can think on why we might be seeing those modulations. That's right. Yes, very nice, you got it.
So in the last plot, in the yellow one, there's a value, well, this frequency value is oscillating, right?
Yep.
But, okay, now, forget it.
Yeah. Any ideas on why the frequency might be trending down?
No. I mean, it's losing energy, so it's slowing down.
Exactly.
Because it's emitting gravitational waves.
Exactly.
And stuff.
Yes, we call that the spin down. Excellent. Do you mind if I sneak by here? Thank you.
Hi. I have a question related to the process. So the Y axis is frequency, right?
Yes.
And is it directly observed or inferred from that amplitude?
Directly observed.
Wow.
Sorry? Yes. And do you notice anything particular about the period of the oscillations? It's about 365 days.
Yeah.
And then what about the top one? What's that period?
That's
24
hours.
Yep.
That's what keeps.
It was. It was.
There you go.
Very nice. Well, good call. Very nice. Yes. All right, good thinking. Hi. All right. Who thinks they have an answer?
Yeah, well, we don't. It doesn't look periodic.
All right, who thinks they have an answer? What's happening here? I see so many hints. Yes.
I think the blue is just as the Earth rotates. You guys are different.
That's true. And then what's the physics behind the frequency shift?
Alignment with the source.
I heard a really nice answer up here from the back of the room earlier. Redshift. That's right. Very good. And then how about
alignment doesn't change with the source, the direction that the signal comes.
Yes.
Around the equator, right?
So the amplitude of the effect will change depending on the angle that you are with respect to how it's spinning. But yes, you're exactly right. And yes, you're right. It's Doppler shift. It's not redshift and blue shift. It's yes. Very nice. And what do we think about this downward trend in the yellow plot here? What's happening there? All right, I think we've heard. How about you, please?
The neutron star is just radiating away energy as it rotates, so the frequency gets small.
Exactly, yes. So we see that this is proportional. The strain amplitude is proportional to that gravitational wave frequency squared. It's radiating away energy. It's going to be spinning down. This is the term that we use in the field. Thank you for letting me squeeze. Okay, very nice. So you're all continuous wave experts now. So let's talk a little bit about how we think about a gravitational wave ends, because there are very different ways of framing this as a problem. So something that I failed to emphasize earlier when we were discussing these mergers is that these systems that have been orbiting each other have been orbiting for millions and millions of years. Yes, you had a question?
Yeah, just from the graph, can you say the period of the neutron star, because it's
yes,
orbital?
Absolutely. And we rely on this fact. So for continuous waves as a multi-messenger source, we rely on this fact from observed pulsars. And it's actually really powerful to know how quickly they're spinning as a function of time and where exactly in the sky they are, because that gives us all of the modulation that we see at this in the previous plot. So we can use, essentially, we can assume that we know exactly what the model of the gravitational wave is going to be. Excellent question. All right, but yes, so for thinking about the end of a source, so we know that mergers will also be losing energy as they're radiating gravitational waves. We know that they emit this chirp, this increase in frequency over time. So remember, continuous waves decrease in frequency, mergers increase in frequency as they're losing energy. So here's a formula that we're going to come back to that's really handy. We can estimate the merger frequency as roughly the frequency of the last stable orbit. So this is the last complete semicircular orbit of the system. So here we've got this really nice approximation that's normalized to solar mass units and hertz. So this is a factor of 220 that comes from that normalization, normalized to an object with a total mass. So this is a total mass would go here, and this is 20 solar masses. So this is going to give us a rough estimation of the frequency at which this is essentially the merger starts to happen. So we can call this the end of a merger, and keep this in mind again for a little bit later today. And meanwhile, yes, so continuous waves, they're spinning down, they're going down in frequency over time. We can estimate this time scale with sort of similar to a cool down strategy. So if you've ever thought about a cool down for hot gases in space, this is a similar kind of strategy. So we have some kind of kinetic energy that we can describe again with the geometry of the neutron star and its rate of spin divided by the luminosity that it's radiating, that we just got a sense of on the last slide. So two very different pictures, different kinetic physics going on, both driven by gravitational radiation. All right, and then the last source that I wanted to touch on in our lightning overview of sources, so I'm not going to tell you too much about the stochastic background today, I'm very sorry about that. So this is Korkalep supernovae. So we can leverage this equation, it's known as the burst equation. If you want to read more about it, you can check out one of the resources on the front page of these slides. But essentially this is telling me that the strain amplitude is proportional to the emitted gravitational wave energy, which is fractionally going to be a lot lower than it is for a merger. So there's going to be less fractional energy, the system that's going into gravitational waves for a Korkalep supernova, because we can't produce the same kind of really well-localized asymmetry in the distribution of mass. It's also inversely proportional to the size of the object, the frequency of the emission, and we're going to get a sense of this from a simulation, roughly what this looks like, and the time scale. So we assume from the garden variety model, so this is a numerical relativity simulation taking into account hydrodynamics and neutrino physics, we can simulate how these events would happen and that they're roughly about on the order of milliseconds, maybe up to roughly about a second or two. So they actually emit, when these systems explode, they emit most of their energy in the form of neutrinos. So only a very small fraction is emitted in gravitational waves. So for this reason, we are a lot less sensitive. So these would have to be a galactic source. So we'd have to get really lucky, maybe with Betelgeuse, in order to see these with gravitational waves. And type 1a supernovae, so not core collapse, but this white dwarf explosion, they're not promising sources. There's a lot less accelerating mass than there is in a really massive star. So let's get a sense of this numerical simulation. So this is a core collapse supernova, just to get a sense of the kind of energy distribution over time. And you can get a sense of the time up at the top there. And again, these are going to last for roughly on the order of a second to a few seconds for most models. But you can get a sense of these really large scale mass outflows. So I don't think it's shown here, but the scale of this simulation is also changing and expanding and growing along with the simulation. So these outflows are on the order of several times the star itself now. But here we can kind of get some kind of a mental model for how we might get the asymmetries that would drive a significant gravitational wave emission, as opposed to something more symmetric. Yes?
Sorry, is this the, like, some matter fields?
Matter fields?
Yeah, that are being shown in the...
Ah, yes, so the color is telling you about the density of matter that's flowing around. Yes, that's a great question. So yes, this isn't showing us neutrinos, it's showing us the way that the neutrinos are driving the mass, which is then going to be generating the gravitational wave signal. Yes, excellent question. All right. So let's say that we have one of these sources and it's doing whatever it's doing. Maybe it's two compact objects that are merging. Maybe it's a rotating neutron star. Maybe it's a core collapse supernova. So it generates that signal. And as that signal propagates through Earth, so let's say as it propagates through the screen here, so coming into or out of the screen, it will essentially produce this change in length over length. It will produce this relative stretching and squeezing of space-time. So you, I assume we'll cover this more in depth next week when you talk with Luis. But what we need to know in order to motivate the shape of our detectors is that there are two polarizations that are orthogonal to each other. Orthogonal in the sense that they're maximally rotated so that you're not getting any overlapping signal between them, which turns out to be 45 degrees for something that's stretching and squeezing into orthogonal directions. So they're named after the mathematical functions that they most, that they best represent. But what I want you to take away from this is two things. So one is that as a gravitational wave propagates, whatever its polarization is, it's going to be producing an orthogonal stretching and squeezing. So when I'm designing my detector, I want to build something that's able to probe something that's alternating stretching and squeezing in an orthogonal direction, which gives us our L shape. And the other thing I want you to notice is that this ring of test masses here is showing me a strain or a change in length over length on the order of 1. And we're looking for a signal that's a strain on the order of 10 to the minus 21. So we're gonna need to do a little bit better than our plain Michelson interferometer that you see here. But this is the basic idea, that we have some coherent laser light. It's split by a beam splitter. Half of it travels in each one of these two orthogonal directions. If we are aligned with in an optimal way with the polarization of the source, then we'll get a maximal signal to noise ratio in our detector. If we're not, then we'll get a little bit lower amplitude signal. But we're essentially using that light, the coherent light, as a reference light for the other arm. So I'll show you an animation first, but then I want to get to the heart of some of the really question for how we can actually do this measurement. All right, so stitching a little bit more of this together. So here we've got our description of the generation of space-time strain that's proportional to our quadrupole moment. That's telling me essentially what the model of my source will be. So I can predict the time series of amplitude of strain over time. And then now I'm projecting this into the effect on a series of test masses that can be probed if I'm able to sense the relative change in length. All right, so a couple questions for you here. So let's just shout this out. What polarization does this source have, if you remember from the last slide? Yes, so we tend to make this approximation. So this is something to watch out for. If you see a waveform, it's usually linearly polarized and plus polarized, just because this is the simplest, it's the most well-aligned with our detectors. So that's something to keep in mind. If it's not specified, that's probably what's happening there. And then another question for you to consider. So how, given the response of these test masses, maybe compare two dots that are close together versus two dots that are far apart, and what that change in length looks like. How long do we want our arm length to be to maximize our strain sensitivity?
As long as possible.
As long as possible. Yes, absolutely. As long as we can make it, as long as it's feasible to make it. So it will turn out that we're going to be able to build these detectors on the scale of kilometers. All right, and let's take a tour, see a little bit more about how this works. So this is in a nutshell. We've got our gravitational wave coming in there. Here's our coherent laser light. We're going to follow half of the beam that's split off in one of the two orthogonal directions. It bounces off of an end mirror. It's going to return back to the beam splitter. And remember, I'm comparing it, this whole design, I'm comparing the yellow light to the red light in terms of the time that it takes it to travel in the arms. That's the measurement that I'm making. And if I introduce a gravitational wave into the plane, if I change the relative length of the arms, I'm changing the travel time of the light. So this is what's happening. We have no sense of the absolute relative distance of our test masses. They don't matter to us. They're approximately 4 kilometers, and that's good enough for us. What we're interested in is the relative travel time of the light. So if you want to think about this as, let's say, a wavefront that's entering the beam splitter at the same time, splits off in two directions. Now my detector is a timer. It's not a ruler. Yes, you had a question?
Yeah. How have they done this so flat surfaces? Because I suppose that you need the distance to be the same along this, like, say, XY axis.
Are you thinking about the curvature of the Earth here?
No. I'm thinking of that surface, that mirror. Light is reflecting,
mm-hmm.
Like you need all the distances up to this 10 to the minus.
Oh, that's right. Yes. So the
exactly the same. Like,
that's right. The polishing.
You cannot have a flat thing because you have like atoms and things.
That's right. So we're actually going to see that we're limited by the thermal Brownian motion of the atoms on the surface of the mirrors. And that's actually introducing displacement noise. That's actually moving the physical distance between the two mirrors enough that we're sensitive to. We'll get there. Hold that thought. We're going to get to noise and challenges. All right, so let's take a little bit of a deeper tour, and we're going to dig a little bit more into the really aspect. How do we really do this in practice? So here we're looking at the LIGO Hanford site. You can only see up to the 2 kilometer mid station there. That's not the full 4 kilometer long arm. It's worth pointing out. And what we're going to do is we're going to fly through and we're going to follow the path of the coherent laser beam. And we're going to get a sense of a little bit more, maybe a second order sense of how the measurement is made. So here we start with this pre-stabilized laser. So it's highly stabilized in both phase and amplitude. And it's steered into this 3-optic cavity that you see here in pink. This is the input mode cleaner, and it selects for this really nice, well-behaved Gaussian spatial beam profile. It's next steered into this 3-optic cavity in yellow. This is the power cycling cavity. What it will do is recycle the light. It will put the light back into the interferometer when it exits the beam splitter. But for now, it'll travel straight on through to the beam splitter. And just like in our simple Michelson case, it's going to split 50% in two directions. And now we get to the arms. So the arms are lined with, each one of them has two parallel test masses. And that's what defines the 4 kilometers in the arm. And they're parallel to form a Fabry-Perot cavity, which is going to recycle the light. It's going to cycle it up by about a factor of 300, so that when we input about 100 or so watts of power, what we get out is close to a megawatt. Yes, we did some calculations about how quickly you could cook an alligator in one of these.
How long?
It's on the order of seconds. So here's one of the test masses. So the beam radius is actually pretty big for an optics experiment. It's about 6 centimeters. And the optics themselves are very heavy. And we'll get a little bit into why that is. But they're about 90 pounds. And then as the light completes its journey in its arm, so it's going to return to the beam splitter, 50% will be recycled in the power recycling cavity, 50% will be recycled in the signal recycling cavity, which serves a similar purpose, until finally it's steered into this last optic mode cleaner. So this is a bow tie cavity that also cleans the light, and finally to our photodiode. So it's worth emphasizing that all of the cavities that we just saw have to be in resonance. They all have to be resonating in order for us to see, to take any data at all. And if we introduce a gravitational wave into the plane of our detectors, this is what we're going to see in the signal recycling cavity and at our photodiode readout. And this is tracing out that this is actually the real, modeled after the real data from LIGO Hanford, which happened to be the more sensitive of the two detectors at the time of the first detection. All right, so how are the people who are thinking really feeling? You getting a little bit more of an intuition, or just more questions? Yes?
Why, what limits us about the traveling time? I mean, you mentioned it's about 300 times, so mm-hmm. why we don't increase that to a couple of thousand times? Because essentially we are increasing the effective path length.
That's exactly right. So we would like to do that if we can, and this comes back to this really nice point over here about the atomic behavior introducing displacement noise. So it's a very fine balance between the reflectivity that you need in order to cycle the light as many times as you can, and every layer of coating that you add introduces thermal noise, which adds to your displacement noise in another way. So yes, it's a fine balancing act, and that's a very good question. Yes?
Maybe just something else I want to put on the list. You don't have to answer it now, but I think this question comes up a lot with gravitational wave detectors, but if you are stretching space-time, aren't you like stretching the signal itself? So could you comment maybe on that at some point as well?
Yes, this is an excellent question. So the idea here, to repeat your question, so if you have an incoming gravitational wave, sure, you're stretching and squeezing your arm length. Aren't you also stretching and squeezing your wavelength? So how does this work at all? How do you get this difference in phase? And the answer actually comes from general relativity. So if we think of this, the light that's coming into the beam splitter as in phase, which is this is why we use coherent light. So we're essentially using them as relative timers. So it's not as helpful to think about it as a ruler. It's much more helpful to think about it as a pulsar timing array, even. So we're timing the relative time that it takes the light to travel, because light will always travel at c. We're leveraging that fact here. So we're introducing this distortion in the path that the light has to travel. It will always travel at c. Therefore, if I extend that length relative to the other arm, I am going to get that phase difference. That light will still continue to evolve in frequency. So it's also worth noting that we can only do this measurement with that reference beam. You have to have that reference laser light. We have no sense of what the absolute scale of the arms are, but yes, that's a great question. Is that more clear? You want to keep going with that? Yes. Okay, very good. Peter Salson wrote a beautiful article about this, by the way, if you want to keep digging into this. It's pretty non-intuitive. I thought I saw a hand up over here. Yes?
It's pretty similar to what I was going to ask. Pretty much like the same thing. But I guess it's like, you know, maybe it's like, we know that the expansion of the universe doesn't mean that, oh, it's stretching the Earth, right? And it's like, you know, and very similar thinking, it's like, okay, well, it's not really that these things, like, you know, I mean, might say this, things aren't really structured, but I guess it's kind of more like the background, which, like, you know, of space-time that is stretching, and it's like, and that affects the path of the light.
Mm-hmm. They are really stretching. They are really stretching. We are all really stretching. We're all in a sea of ambient gravitational waves all the time. Our atoms are stretching all over the place relative to each other.
Like, it gets pulled, but then it's like, you know, the explanation is that, well, our internal forces pull us back, and it's like, you know, but it is, like, there are tidal forces, but it's like, you know, but are we looking for, like, are we really looking for these stretches between the paths, or is it more so like this, just like, you know, that light is like traveling through space-time, and it's kind of like, you know, and it's more so that it's like, in a way, light is kind of suspended away from the Earth, because it's not actually, like, anchored on Earth. I'm not sure how to phrase this, but like,
yes.
You know, but.
Well, I think I can see what you're getting at here. So we can use physical space as a proxy, a direct proxy for space-time, and light's experience in that space-time is going to mirror its experience in a real physical space. And this will come up again when we're designing bigger and bigger detectors, because very importantly, we are always going to need to keep our light in a straight line. This will come up, the curvature of the Earth, by the way. Yes?
Is the frequency of the light affected by the gravitational waves?
Ooh. Yes. So if a gravitational wave is stretching and squeezing space-time, or stretching and squeezing the wavelength of the light, that's true.
That can also affect this thing that everything stretches, but the light gets more affected.
I think of it as, so let's say I've got a wavefront that's coming into my beam splitter, and that wavefront is now off at the speed of light in two different directions. So we can measure by that particular reference point. So there is going to be one of those two wavefronts that returns earlier if there is a relative change in distance, and then the second photon, and so on. So it is a coherent effect when you integrate it all together, but it's probably simplest to think of it from a single reference frame rather than the wavelength of the light. Yes, great question. Okay, I think I saw this hand first, and then we'll go here.
Would this also work if you have like a 4 kilometer arm and a 1 kilometer arm? You use 2 4-kilometer arms so that you are sensitive to both directions in the same way?
So we're gonna get the strongest signal when the path that the light has traveled is the same on average. So let's say there's no gravitational wave that's perturbing the relative distance. It will work best. We'll get the highest amplitude signal if that path is as similar as we can make it. And it's not perfect. You know, the optic codings aren't exactly the same.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, it's rather you try to get no interference. And it's not like you measure perfectly 4 kilometers. Probably you do close to perfect. But the more important thing is that you measure no interference when there's no gravitational wave, right?
That is definitely a requirement.
Okay.
But yeah, I think thinking about the two paths where you want your buddy photon, the one that you're comparing your other reference photon against, you really want it to be having as similar an experience as you can. Okay, yes?
Yeah, regarding to your question, so why frequency of the laser matters here? I couldn't get that. I mean, I thought we are comparing, in the end, we have like frequency filters, I thought, and then essentially we are measuring the intensity, the change in the intensity of.
That's right. So the frequency of the laser only matters in the sense that when we design our detector, we're going to need to have the light path have certain properties. So, fun fact, the ND-YAG 1064 nanometer laser was chosen because it is very stable. It's been worked on for decades. The coatings that reflect it well are very well understood. Yes, more engineering practicalities. Yes, all the way in the back.
Because in terms of increasing the arm length, wouldn't depending on the laser make a problem in terms of diffraction from the laser's emitting aperture as it emits, it sort of widens, basically half angle increases as we increase that. I mean, I think it should depend on the laser and the I don't know the exact term, but could that in theory make a problem if we want to increase the output?
Yes. So we'll actually see that for Lisa, by the time the laser arrives at the other detector, it will start out, you know, on the order of about this big and end up meters and meters wide. So on the Earth, that's not something that we're too concerned about. But it is going to limit practically, well, for also just the cost of digging dirt reasons, it's going to limit us to about on the order of tens of kilometers. That's about as big as we can go on Earth, in part for this reason, but also for many other reasons. But yes, excellent question. And then I saw a hand up here.
Just so I understand, hypothetically, if there was a source at the center, like a very early laser starts, you wouldn't see a signal. Because both your arms would experience exactly the same thing.
So yes. There are a few different ways that we could conceive of not seeing any signal, even in the presence of a gravitational wave. If we could hyper-localize the effect of the gravitational wave here, which no astrophysical source that we know of should do that, they should be fairly isotropic in terms of the direction. But yes, that's one of them. Another one, actually, you may have given me a very good transition here in terms of the antenna pattern and the sensitivity of the detectors. But before we go on, were there any other burning questions about, yes?
You had mentioned there were like additional elements halfway down the green path.
What was that? Ah, that is a building. So.
No, I mean, in the optical diagram, there were like other elements where the path went through.
You mean about 2 kilometers into the arm?
Very close to the.
Very close. Ah, you want to know all of the mirrors.
I was just wondering why you have like something that looks like it's right in the middle of the beam. Like,
that usually
was like some kind of thing that like you had the diagram like this where it was like that and like that, but then you had like something in the middle here, even in the cartoon.
It was like,
is that what you're talking about? Like,
yeah, like even in the cartoon there was something in the middle of the reflection over here. Like you know, there's
oh, that is aha, like okay, I see what you mean. Yes. So that is one of the 2 test messes, one of the 2 parallel optics that's defining the 4-kilometer-long arm. So once the photon passes through that optic, it's entered the Fabry-Pérot cavity and it's contributing to the cycled power in the arm. And we want to get that as high as we can. That's going to amplify the amplitude of our signal. Yes, excellent question. Sorry that I took a while to get there with you, but yes, that's one of the 2 parallel test mass optics, our most important optics. All right, interesting. I could tell you stories about the building though. I was very ready to talk about that. All right, so let's forge ahead. So here is, if I took a time series of our data and I transformed it into the frequency domain, this is what I would see. So this is a Fourier transform of some pretty typical LIGO data. So here we've got strain noise amplitude on the y-axis versus frequency, and it has this very characteristic shape where we are most sensitive, and you may have heard this about ground-based detectors, but we're most sensitive in the band of around hundreds of hertz. Those are higher frequency sources in the gravitational wave landscape of possible sources. But we essentially use 3 different types of technology. Let me see if I put them here. I did. Amazing. Okay, so there are 3 different frequency regimes that I want to introduce you to in terms of what's driving the shape of this curve. So 1 at low frequency, this is dominated by seismic noise. And if you want to understand why we went for nearly 15 years without seeing any signals at all, and then immediately went to seeing high SNR, gorgeous, beautiful signals, you can think this detection, this detector technology. So what you're seeing here, so this blue structure, so by the way, just for sense of scale, I would come up maybe here on this. It's about, let's say, maybe 12 feet high, a little bit more. So what it's doing is it's actually reading in the ambient ground motion. It's predicting how this platform that's supporting the instrumentation will respond, and then it's actively pushing on it to cancel that motion out. And this is extremely expensive and very effective. So this has really unlocked this lower frequency regime relative to earlier versions of our detectors. And then above about 50 hertz now, we are currently fully quantum limited. And that means we're dominated by photon shot noise. So this fuzziness of photons as they're encountering our photodiode readout. And there are a few different ways of combating this. So this uncertainty, like with many uncertainties, actually scales. It can reduce, or it scales with 1 over the square root of whatever the thing is that you're counting. So in this case for us, this is photons that are cycling in the Fabry-Pérot cavity arms. So we can put more power into the arms. So this is a picture of our laser system at LIGO Hanford. We can also recycle the light. So we saw the power cycling cavity, the signal cycling cavity, the Fabry-Pérot cavities help us get up to that roughly 0.5 megawatt that we expect to get up to. And then the last thing that I want to mention is right down here at the most sensitive part of our frequency range, here we're getting to the dreaded Brownian motion. So this is a really big limitation for us. We're not quite there yet, but we will come to sit on displacement introduced by the tiny motions of the atoms on the surface of the optics themselves. And here we come again to the balance between wanting those optics to be very highly reflective to help with the shot noise, but the more layers we add to them, the worse this thermal noise problem gets. Yes?
So cooling down the mirrors, right?
We are not, actually. This is all room temperature. our sister detector, Kagra, is a cryogenic underground detector that's pioneering a lot of that really key technology, but it's very difficult. They've encountered a lot of engineering problems that they're working through. Yes?
What are the spikes?
Yes, great question. So essentially when you're reading this, the spikes mean that there's something that's sinusoidal, essentially, that's happening in the data. This is the 60 hertz power grid line and harmonics. And then what you're seeing here starting at about 500 hertz are what we call the violin modes. And I don't remember if I put a more detailed picture here, but they come from mechanical resonances of these very thin silica fibers that we fuse the test masses to the stage above them. So we try and seismically isolate them by putting them in a pendulum, and then you try to make that fiber as thin as you can so that you don't have thermal dissipation, so that you keep that thermal noise down. But we do have this beautiful set of violin modes that really do mean violin. So they're extremely easily excited, and then they'll ring for many, many hours unless you damp them out. And they have extremely small harmonics, and then also you can see this sort of broadening, which means that we have slightly different frequencies that are interacting in interesting ways at higher frequencies. Great question. And this mess down here, that's the calibration lines. We have control over that. We can move those around. Yes?
I was a little bit lost with the first kind of noise.
Oh, the seismic noise. This guy? Yes, we live on a very seismically active planet, and humans don't help with that. Yes, so this is direct displacement introduced just from the Earth below the test masses shaking around.
Do we know sources of seismic noise properly?
We do.
Everything?
Well, we have...
How can we anticipate all of them?
Well, we have seismometers which measure the ground motion that are much better seismometers than our interferometer is, which is where that's the way around that you want it, definitely. So we have very detailed measurements of what the ground motion is doing as a function of frequency. It affects us in different ways at different frequencies. So for example, way below where you can even see here on this plot, where earthquake Rayleigh waves propagate through the Earth's crust, that hurts us because it tends to shake the optics so much that we lose light resonance. So that affects our duty cycle, even though you don't see it as much here in our sensitivity. It's the humans that are a problem often, introducing transient bursts of higher frequency seismic noise. So trucks, planes, trains, walking around, will jiggle the optics a little bit at a lower frequency that will then upconvert to a higher frequency that can actually produce what we call glitches, little bursts of noise on the detector. That can be really confusing for our searches, as we will see in a little bit. All right, I see we're already at the almost hour mark, which is wonderful and terrifying. So I'm gonna bring us ahead here and give you a two-scale demonstration, an animated simulated demonstration of our current sensitivity. So we start zooming around with the electron outside of the hydrogen atom. We're zooming all the way down into the surface of the proton. And this again is two-scale, the relative displacement measurement that we can make. And then you divide this number by 4 kilometers to get the strain. So remember that that's the number we were after, is 10 to the minus 21. Yes, and you can find this online, by the way. This is if you go to LIGO Lab Gallery, they've got lots of wonderful videos like this that you can see. And here's a tour of our partner site. So there are 2 LIGO detectors in the US. One is very close to UBC, actually. It's a lovely 5-hour drive. One is in Louisiana. We have a 3-kilometer long detector in Virgo, called Virgo, that's in Italy. We mentioned Kagra. That's the cryogenic pioneer detector underground near Kamiokande. And here we've got LIGO India, where we have very exciting news that the Indian government has fully funded construction of this 3rd LIGO site. So this will be a 3rd 4-kilometer long LIGO detector that will be brought on with this more advanced sensitivity. All right, so why is this useful to introduce multiple detectors to you? So I would like to tell you now about the peanut. This is a famous shape, and what it does is it traces out where in the sky we are sensitive to. If you have an L-shaped detector, essentially all L-shaped detectors will have a similar sensitivity pattern. So the way to read this, so the arms of the detectors are aligned with the axis here, where we've got out of the plane of the detector is up. So this is the darkest color in red and blue. We are maximally sensitive in those directions for a gravitational wave that's coming into or out of the plane of the detector. And you may notice that we're sensitive to almost the whole sky. We have some sensitivity in most directions except for gravitational waves that are propagating at this 45 degree angle, this one particular angle where you won't introduce any relative stretching or squeezing. So this is important in terms of figuring out where these things come from. So if we're sensitive to most of the sky, so think of a microphone in a room, how can we tell which direction a source is coming from relative to Earth? So let's take a couple minutes. I'll give you a hint, it's related to the a couple of slides ago, but let's see what we think.
That's probably
pipe. What are we thinking here? Yes, it's going to be dominated by the time of arrival of the signal. Yep. And you're absolutely right, though, that the antenna patterns can help a lot. But it's a second order helping a lot. It will be, very similar to triangulating earthquakes.
That means having three is much better than having two.
It does. Right, yeah. It does, exactly.
Right. So think of for GPS, for example.
Exactly. Yep. And yes, the more you add, the better you do. And the farther apart they are, the better you do. We tried to build one in Australia. It didn't work out so well.
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
The Australian government, this is pre-detection.
Okay.
They looked at, so the NSF proposal was, we will give you all of the detector components, the seismic isolation, the optics, everything. You have to build the vacuum and run it. And that was a $100 million price tag, and they said, no, thank you. Which is understandable.
Yeah, but probably in retrospect, they're like,
oh, yeah. Well, the irony is that they've spent more money than that now building this great big OSGRAV Center of Excellence. But that was post-detection. But here we are. It's happening. It'll be in India. That'll be helpful. It's pretty far, yeah. We'll shoot for a Southern Hemisphere detector for the next generation.
Use the gravitational wave itself?
Sorry?
We're answering this question. We should use the gravitational wave itself or observation separately.
Well, yeah. I think you'll find it helpful to compare how the different observatories are observing the signal.
Not too much for you, or it is possible.
So, well, let's think about it this way. All right, so we've got this room, right? And I put a microphone here, here, and there. And I turn on some sinusoidal signal so that you can make a really simple bandpass filter and just get some blips. How would you tell where in the room I am?
We should find the resonance, right?
Let's say you know what the frequency is already. Let's say I tell you, I have a tuning fork, and you know what the frequency is. So all that you need to do for data analysis is look for changes in amplitude of that frequency. So let's say I give you a time series from each one of those microphones, and it's got spikes in it at slightly different times. How would you tell where in the room I was hitting the tuning fork?
Answer.
All right, we're getting there. Yes, we're... We're getting there. Yeah, all right. I'd love to keep this going, but I feel like I can. Our list is drifting away from us. Okay. Does anybody, I see a hand up in the back already. Please, go ahead.
So some astrophysical events besides emitting gravitational also can emit sort of electromagnetic radiation. So using telescopes on Earth or in space, we can track the position. I don't know if all astrophysical events also have this extra piece of information we can use, but I will say most.
Amazing. So multi-messenger astronomy, that's excellent. And there's a piece that we can provide to our astronomer partners in terms of where they might want to point their telescopes. And I see a hand down here. Yes?
If we have more than one detector, then just a time delay between the signal of one detector and the other tells us which sort of direction it's coming from.
That's right. So what we're going to be able to provide those telescopes, which is an excellent suggestion, is a sky map that's consistent with the relative time of arrival of the signal between detectors. Yes, excellent. Another hand, yes?
So could it also be, when if the gravitational lens is coming from this way, it will project that on the plane of the observer, that should sort of affect how the lens are contracted or strained relative to each other. Maybe that wouldn't be enough to determine exactly the angle, but might sort of give you some.
You're absolutely right. So if we take the signal and we project it onto what we know about the antenna pattern for our detectors, that is going to help us to constrain the direction. The time delay is going to dominate where, so it's going to, we go from a circle on the sky if we've got two detectors to a little bundle if we've got three detectors, and doing better than that, yes, we'll need to use the antenna pattern. And there's a great story about Virgo here where, so the very first discovery where we had a kilonova that was discovered with telescopes was one of the best sky maps that we've been able to constrain for this reason. We got very lucky that the gravitational wave came in like this to Virgo. So Virgo saw nothing, and that was amazing. All right, I saw a hand up over here, I guess.
Yeah, now this only works if we're having a sustained wave, we could consider as it goes out throughout the day, the detector is going at different angles, so it will trace the path throughout the peanut. But if it's a short-lived one, you can't do that. But
yes, but that's an excellent suggestion, and one that Lisa is going to rely very heavily on for its sky localization. Very nice. Okay, yes?
I was wondering if the curvature of the Earth helps you if you have one detector that's like that, you get away close to maybe, like, for example, close to you, but if the other detector is like on another plane, maybe you get some information from that, like the difference between.
It helps a little bit. So you can sort of think of the two LIGO detectors on the surface of North America are almost in the same plane, effectively, but they're broken a little bit by the curvature of the Earth. You can still draw a straight line through the Earth between them, so that's why I think of them. I tend to think of them as about on the same plane. But yes, so what you're getting at, though, is that you want these to be as distant as you can make them. So yes, ideally we would want one somewhere in the Southern Hemisphere, for example, which we don't currently have, but hopefully sometime in the future. All right, very good. So here are some examples of typical sky localizations, and you'll start to notice some patterns here as you stare at it. A lot of them look like rings or parts of rings or double bananas or this chaos that has two lobes. You'll recognize that chaos with two lobes as the peanut. If we only have one detector online, we're just going to recover that antenna pattern, essentially. So the very well localized examples that you see here, so those are essentially require us to have three detectors online at the same time in order for that sky map to be fairly well localized. So it's also worth pointing out to your telescope's point, which is a really good one, that for gravitational waves, tens of square degrees for us is an excellent localization. That's almost about as small as we can make them in area. And if you're trying to work through a field that's 10 square degrees with a telescope that's supposed to really dig deep in a very small area of the sky, they think of those as very large, 10 square degrees. All right, and here's the Virgo story, actually. So here we've got the Virgo beam pattern, where the null points that you're seeing here, so that's coming into or out of this 45-degree angle. Here is above or below the detector in the dark red. And this double banana that you see here in blue, so that's what you get with the two LIGO detectors. You get the ring from the timing delay, and we do a little bit better than the ring with our antenna pattern for the LIGO detectors. And then because the signal is so close to this null point, Virgo was able to put a really good constraint on it, and that's how we identified the kilonova for this first multi-messenger event. And let's see here. This is a fun animation to see also. So if you look at the timing from gamma ray satellite information, so that was Fermi and integral, you would also get a ring. And this is how much better we can do with gravitational waves when we have three detectors online at the same time. And then this is actually an image of the kilonova that was identified. So this is the host galaxy NGC 4993. All right, so let's put this all together. This is a summary. So we've got two compact objects. They're radiating gravitational waves. They merge. The signature of the dynamics of that merger propagates out at the speed of light. It travels for billions and billions of light years, generally. So this one was about 13 or so billion light years before reaching the Earth, where we get that crystal clear signature. I'm going to warn you that this is vastly exaggerated. You'll understand why in a moment. We refer to this as the Jello Earth. It gets better. But that signal at a vastly smaller amplitude will propagate through our detector. So we'll introduce this relative change in length between these two orthogonal directions, and this is the signal that we would see at our photodiode readout. So here is a summary. This is an overview of gravitational wave detection and experiments, and now it's time for us to move and make some new friends and colleagues and switch topics. Hello. Very good. Yes, please. If you're comfortable with that.
One question there. The first multi-messenger event, was it just coincident that the telescope was pointing there, or were they sensitive for a large area?
They were searching for a large area for a long time, and actually we got unlucky with this. The signal was registered just about as night was ending in South Africa.
Yeah, because I cannot see how in 1.7 seconds or whatever, I think 1.7 seconds, right, they would point their telescope in the right
direction. No, they had a short window where it was still dark enough to potentially find it with telescopes in South Africa, and then it was dawn, and then night traveled all the way across the Atlantic Ocean before a telescope in Chile found it 9 hours later.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, agreed. We're switching groups. There's a lovely seat right here. That's true.
I remember that one time, like somebody locked their Toyota and lost a body on the time.
Are you not staying here?
I have stuff up there. What if I want to write something down?
Ah, okay. Well, you're welcome to go grab it and come back down here if you'd like to.
Okay, I have not written a note down anymore.
I don't think we're going to need to, at least off the top of my head, remember that I've planned any calculations.
This is very close. It's not
so hello. All right, everybody. I hope you had the time to introduce yourself to your new team. We're going to do some more thought exercises. Enough of you moved, I think. We have sufficient mixing. Okay, yeah, this looks good. All right, so we're going to spend a little bit of time on data analysis now. So we're going to focus on compact binary coalescences, and we'll start with the types of sources that we might see and how we'd see them if we could build a perfect optical telescope. So if you could point your telescope and perfectly resolve these black holes, this is the distortion that we would see. This is also an overdense stellar background, among other things. But this is what general relativity tells us should happen. And now, of course, we can't build a perfect telescope, and generally our background is much, much too dark to have this kind of resolution. So instead...
Sorry, can I?
Yes. Sure. Yes. There we go.
So these outside of these two black circles are just stars.
That's right.
So there was a circle.
Yeah, it was around, guys. Like a circle.
There was another circle. If you play it again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is that?
So this comes from the bending of the two black holes as a body. So from very, very distant stars and galaxies that are being bent. So essentially this is based on one of the simulations that they pioneered for Interstellar. So this is telling you about, yes, so the light path is reacting to both the two individual black holes and then also the system as a whole, the body. But yeah, that's a really, I don't know that anybody's ever pointed that out before. That's nice observation.
Why is there like a maximum at some distance from this merger? I would have expected to have a maximum close to mergers.
I think, so are you saying a maximum?
For example, you can see this ring.
Ah, mm-hmm.
And it seems like, I don't know, like stronger effect at those distances.
Yes, so yeah, we can map the distortion of space-time. Yeah, I think, well, this might become a little bit more clear if we do the projection into space-time, if you'd find that helpful. But just hold on to your thought that there is going to be a point right at about here-ish where you're going to start to see the curvature become really important and very steep. So yeah, let's take a look at that and see if we find this helpful. So right about here-ish, for example, we are going to find this mirror in terms of the space-time. Well, now we've zoomed in too far to really see it. as clearly as we were at a distance with our optical simulation. But essentially, this is what we're seeing. It does get quite steep quite fast. All right, excellent question. But yes, so this is one of the most famous simulations produced by the SXS collaboration of a gravitational waveform that matches the first detected signal. So here we are tracing out our gravitational wave amplitude as a function of time. It's behaving exactly as we've derived we'd expected it to, up to including this merger. So remember now, here we're in the realm of numerical relativity. This is going to be the peak amplitude of the signal as those two black holes merge, and then this final object is going to ring down again like the bell, which does carry also a lot of really interesting physics in it. If we ever achieve the SNR to probe that, which I expect that we will for future generation detectors, and here we have that signature flying out towards Earth at the speed of light. And we can do even one more projection. So let's say that we are operating somewhere above two black holes or neutron stars, but two compact objects, and we have a series of test masses. How would they be oscillating in response to the system distorting the space-time around those two objects? So this is another nice way, I think, to visualize, to make the connections between how this mass distribution is changing over time and what effect we expect to observe in space-time strain. All right, with that intuition building, we'll come back just for a moment to remind ourselves what we'd said about constructing templates. So we have this really nice weak field approximation where we're treating our compact objects like point sources. This is valid up until about the merge, and then we have numerical relativity takeover, but we can generate thousands, even millions of templates by stitching together interpolations between numerical simulations and in spiral analytical models. So let's say we've done this, that we've constructed some number of templates. Now this is our challenge. So we've got this very noisy detector data. We saw that it's sensitive to 10,000 times the diameter of a proton. There's not a lot that it takes to move the detector very little bit. So we've got this noisy data. So this is this dark blue, white and strain amplitude, and buried in this noise, we've got the signal, and our advantage here is that we know what we're looking for. So let's do a challenge. Let's take even 5 minutes to chat with your neighbors, and I want you to try to conceive of a method for searching for compact binary coalescences. So we know that they're very weakly interacting. We know we have signals correlated across detectors, and we can predict, let's assume, essentially exactly what the signal is going to look like for a wide variety of masses and spin combinations. So let's take somewhere between 3 to 5 minutes, talk with your teams, see if you can come up with some proposals. This one or the one before? This one? How are we doing here? Yeah?
The idea would be to go to it and understand how to split the two signals, right?
Well, our primary goal, so let's say that all that we first know is just what's in the dark blue. So our goal is to try to devise a way that we can tease out the presence of the lighter, the quieter signal in the noisy data.
I mean, we know what the noise is, right? So that's the thing, we subtract it from the signal.
We can predict what the shape of the noise could be, what the relative frequency components will be, but we don't know what the time series of the noise is.
Because I always thought that the idea would be just I let my detector just detect the noise, and then I just subtract that, and what is not that I call it signal. But I'm really not in that.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, here we're not going to be able to predict what the signature of our noise is going to be. Yeah.
But also, I actually had a signal related to like every time that I. But every time you see like discussing a signal of merging, there's always this nice picture of there is somewhere this merging and then this conventional waves that arrives here. But like are these so rare that we detect one by one?
Right
it's
now
really
that's true. Hard. Yep.
Okay. Even if we have like because gravitational waves don't interact with almost anything, so they are like so we, I expect that we detect really every rotation, every merging that will happen in the universe. But still, they are so rare that we can distinguish them.
They are rare in local space. So the rate of them is fairly rare, which means that so that they're happening all the time, but they're too far away for us to be getting a high rate of them.
I said it, they go away. Because even if they are low, the universe is very big.
So exactly, exactly. All right, yeah, it looks like we're getting a lot of good discussion here. Yeah, thanks for chatting.
I'm really inexperienced in this area, but why we can't do the same thing in the noise cancellation thing in the UFO?
We don't know the noise. So the reason we can do the seismic cancellation is because we have a seismic monitor that's monitoring exactly what that seismic signal is.
Yeah.
And we have some combination of those sources that we don't all have monitors for. So we don't know what that time series is in dark blue.
We do know that, so for example, because they are compact, they, as they go, they start to spiral faster and faster, so they emit more energy. So the roughly the shape of the signal that we should detect is something that starts low and then oscillates very fast.
Yeah.
And about the data analysis part, I don't know, but can we look for such a thing in all the things we have, or?
Yes, we absolutely can.
Okay, so like that light blue line that we have over there, right? It starts oscillating slowly, but as they get closer to each other, they get closer to the full merger, right?
Yep.
They emit more energy, they're still faster, right?
Yep. Exactly.
So I don't know.
Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit more about the math behind this, but you can actually compare that model that you described very well directly to your data and see where you're finding good matches.
Oh, okay. And one more general question. Given all the recent fuss about neural networks and that sort of stuff, are people working on training machines that can do much of this stuff?
They are, and they're very helpful in cases where the method that we're going to go over, which is called match filtering, don't work as well. So match filtering is optimal if your noise is Gaussian. You can't do better than match filtering. If your model is accurate and your noise is Gaussian, there's almost no point in thinking about machine learning. However, our noise is not Gaussian. We have a lot of noise features in the data that can mimic gravitational waves, as we're going to see in a little bit. So machine learning is actually very useful for that. Yeah, great question. Yeah. All right. We've got a lot of good ideas over here on the side of the room. How are we doing? Yes?
I know only one thing, that we need several detectors.
Okay, several that's so, going to be very helpful.
Yeah, because we need to find a lack of correlation between the noises. And
that's right.
It's impossible with one detector.
It's very hard. We do have one single detector candidates, but they have to be much higher amplitude signals to stand out above the noise. That's right. Yes.
As physicists, we love Fourier transforms. We perform the Fourier transform.
Yes, we do. Absolutely. Well, so we could do this in time or frequency domains, and different search algorithms have different approaches with different advantages. But yes, sure, let's take a Fourier transform. I love that. Yes. Yes, okay. You.
If you have like different bins of frequency, I would think you have like a higher dimension data. Can we do a PCA, this principal component analysis? So we search first for the correlation matrix of the data, then we diagonalize that, we order that from higher to lower values, and we just keep the highest value so that we can see. Like, maybe we can get rid of noise and see these correlations better.
Yes, I really like the direction that you're taking us, which is to steer, to look for matches for the form, the model, that we know that we're after. We know we could draw the PCA of the model even, and then compare that to the data. We're going to be able to do something even simpler mathematically when we get there. Did I see a hand up over here?
Sorry, I had one question. The signal that we get out of
it's a time series that looks very similar to the dark blue, which we could take the Fourier transform of, and we often do.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not a fully baked thought, but could we leverage the fact that we expect a certain Doppler shift and say stretch one signal, shrink the other, and try to correlate that? And if there's some correlation after that stretching, then it's like we know better that it's like that it had to have come from, like, you know, space, and it would be affected by the different locations on the Earth.
So this is something that we must do for long duration signals, and we'll have to start thinking about this as our detectors get more sensitive and our signals spend longer in band than less than a second or seconds.
Yeah, but like, you know, for like, even when you're talking about like short-lived stuff like this, like if you have a detector on opposite sides of the Earth, then it's like, you know, then you would get the same signal. And, you know, of course, you can't wait an entire day for this 1 second signal. So it's like, So if you did that for, like, you know, even without, even just like having two detectors on different sides of the arc, then you could perform that even for short-lived signals too.
Okay, very good. So we've got some themes here, and they're really good. So we're going to leverage our model. We know that our model, that GR, describes this behavior very well, and we know that gravitational waves are not going to be altered in their morphology by the time they reach Earth. So we're going to leverage our model. We're going to leverage our detector network. We're going to look for something consistent with the same model across our detector network. Did I see a hand up over here?
Yeah, I can. So in this manner, we can produce the model waveform. We have catalog of waveforms, then we can basically through that, through the data, and calculate the SNR.
Yes, we can. SNR. Okay, you're familiar with this, I see.
Yeah,
yes.
I was falling in the end.
Okay, very good.
I guess then also we have to check in the other detector. If we see in both, then we can say, okay, we are seeing an event, otherwise it's like a false alarm or something.
Yes, okay, so let's put this to math, and I want to ease us into this a little bit, because I think this is new for a lot of people. So, we're going to do this challenge together. Can you tell me what this is an image of, this noisy image?
Elephant.
Wow. Wow. We've got some Star Wars fans here. That was incredible. All right, so we need to make a CBC detector at least as good as that. Amazing. All right, so if I had told you that you were looking for Star Wars characters, or characters within a certain model, or roughly, you know, give you any kind of indication for, give you some kind of model for what's in your data. So we could do what's called match filtering, which is a very powerful technique, and it's actually optimal in terms of signal processing. So if you know that your model accurately describes the signal that you're looking for, what you can do is take the inner product between your model and your data. So here we've got some data in S, and then we break our model down into sine and cosine components. We take this inner product, which we define as the inner product normalized by the detector noise. So we're weighting the power in the signal as it's seen through the lens of the detector by dividing it by our detector noise. That's this capital S term there. And then essentially what we're doing is exactly as you said. We're going to take this bank of waveforms. For each waveform in that bank, we're going to walk it across the data, and we're going to compute this cross-correlation. We're going to compute that inner product, and this is exactly as you said, the signal-to-noise ratio. So this is going to give me a time series that does a few different things. So I have this time of arrival, the spike, which we call the merger time. So this is the time where the template and the data are maximally aligned, and we happen to index that by the merger time. So this is going to tell me, if I compare this across my detector network, where in the sky the signal is likely to be. The amplitude is also very important. So this is a first estimate, a first measurement of the amplitude of the signal as it appears in my data. And I can look for, so if I have a million templates, as we do, roughly about a million, I can look for the one that produces the highest SNR around this time, and I can make sure that they're consistent across my detector network. So I'm performing this match filtering for every independent time series that I have in my detector network, and then I'm comparing essentially this SNR time series, these triggers across that network. And another way to think about this SNR, so here we've got the noise curves for the two LIGO detectors in red and blue down here. And then we've also got three different examples of gravitational waves from binary black holes. And essentially what we're doing when we're taking this integral is we're adding up, we're summing up all of the area between the signal and the noise. So this is essentially what this math is telling us. It's computing this area under the signal amplitude and then above the noise amplitude. All right, so here's a question for you and your team. Let's just take maybe 30 to 60 seconds to think about this. Shoot from the hip. Which of these signals do you think is a higher single detector match filter SNR? And note that they have very different timescales. Color is the amplitude, the relative amplitude of the signal. They are comparable in terms of normalized or whitened amplitude or energy. That's the color scale is comparable in both of them. All right, so let's take a minute or two and think about that. Which do we think has a higher matched filter SNR? Let's just take a minute or so. Well, it is the one on the larger time scale, but it's because we're integrating over the entirety. Yes. So it's the one on the right clearly has a higher peak amplitude. The one on the left is much, much, much longer in bands. All of those cycles are adding SNR. Yeah. Yeah. Great question. All right. Did anybody want to guess? Yes.
I wager the left one because it's narrower, and that means that you have less frequency variation from the original prediction.
All right, we've got to vote for left. Who agrees with left? Okay. Wow, we're pretty evenly split. Who votes for right? Okay. Well, I will reveal to you the answer. So team right is correct that the peak amplitude is higher, and this is exactly as we expected from our intuitive approximation of strain from binary black holes. However, when we compute the SNR, we integrate, and we can integrate either in time or in frequency if we wanted to do this in the Fourier domain. So notice how much longer the signal is in bands. It goes on for tens of seconds as opposed to milliseconds, and every single one of those thousands of cycles is adding SNR to our calculation. So although it looks like the signal's pretty faint, this is actually the highest SNR signal that we've recorded so far. When you look through the lens of matched filtering, this is a very powerful technique. All right, I think I wanna just give you enough to give you some intuition for the kind of impact that spin has. I see we're already a little bit over our coffee break time, and I want to get just a little bit further. So I'll leave this to Luis. You can tell him I've left him a lot of homework. So here is a non-spinning system. So we've got two black holes. Those are the red dots here. And they're going to produce this very familiar picture. So here we're only going up to the merger time. We're not using numerical relativity to go all the way through to the ring down. Here's one more question for you. Let's take another 60 seconds. We do not have the tools to understand this, so this is really just a guess. Actually, maybe let's just do this together and guess together, because I don't expect you to be able to arrive at the answer based on what we've said so far. So let's make a guess. If the component objects have spin that's aligned with the orbital angular momentum, what is this going to do to the length of this template? If we start from the same reference frequency, is this going to go on for longer? Is it going to be shorter? Let's take a guess. So who wants to vote for longer? Okay, we've got a couple for longer. Most of us are gonna vote for I don't know. Who votes for shorter? Okay, about the same. The same? Okay, and how about I don't know? Fair enough. It is actually longer. So this is a really, really cool effect that you should ask Luis to explain to you. It's called frame dragging. And it will actually drag the signal to evolve for a little bit longer in time. But what I want to get across here in these plots is that it's not just the mass that can affect the morphology of the signal. The spin also has an impact that we can observe. So our template bank, when we're making this bank of models, has to include both information about the mass and information about the spin in order to be able to accurately identify all of the possible candidates we could have in the data. So that's why our template bank looks the way that it does.
Sorry,
yes?
Just a short question. Is it always enhanced for aligned and exactly anti-aligned spin?
Well, this is a very good question that actually leads in here. So chi-effective is what's most important here. So chi-effective is the projection of the individual spins onto the orbital angular momentum. So chi-effective for each one of those. If they are aligned, they're going to, yes, always tend to drive. If they're over a 90-degree angle aligned, they will tend to drag the signal on longer. And then, yes, exactly, anti-aligned will have the opposite effect. Very good. But now that we've introduced the term chi-squared, I can tell you about the colors. So this is broken up just to give you a sense of what a template bank looks like. Just picture a million points. Each one of those points is the full evolution in spiral merger ring down of a source. This is the primary mass, which you might remember is the heavier of the two arbitrarily, and the secondary mass, which gives us this arbitrary dividing line here. And the colors are actually constraints on the spins. So anything that's consistent with a neutron star, we actually place an extra constraint on it to limit the number of templates in our template bank, because neutron stars are actually the most expensive because we integrate over them for the longest time. So here, we can constrain everything consistent with a neutron star to have a spin of less than 0.05, which is consistent with neutron stars in our own galaxy. So we have electromagnetic observations that tell us that this may be a limit for neutron star spin. We have no such constraints for black holes, so they vary up to almost maximal spin. So again, each one of those dots is a model. And now let's do this just a couple more times and we'll make a different point. Yes, we've already got it. Yes. We're doing Star Wars characters. Very, very good. All right, one more. Who's this guy? Ooh. Ooh. Some people are feeling like it's a little bit off.
It's a Lego world, kind of.
Or Legos. So this brings us to noise. And this brings us to challenges. We do have, we call them glitches. They are my personal nemesis. They exist in the data and they mimic gravitational waves like this adorable dog. All right, so let's see. We'll take just a couple, if it's okay to break just a little bit more into coffee, we'll evolve just a little bit more. But this is something that we think a lot about in terms of, all right, we have a trigger. So let's say we have some high SNR for some templates across our detector network. Now the challenge is to figure out how significant is that? So how likely is it that my detector noise is going to produce something that looks like that trigger? So what we do here is we can actually compare the value of the detector network SNR. So this is just the quadrature sum of all the different SNRs of the contributing detectors in my network. We compare that directly to an empirical measurement of how often the detectors produce noise. And because our noise is so ill-behaved, we can't actually do this with a model. We have to do it empirically. So I'll tell you just a little bit about how this is done. So again, this is the foreground. We take those coincidence triggers between however many detectors we have in our network. So this is two, for example. And then this is our network SNR, just the quadrature sum of each of the contributing SNRs. And then to calculate the noise background, what we actually do is we take the real data, the triggers, and we slide them in time by some amount of time greater than the gravitational wave travel time. So now we have excluded the possibility that we're going to be matching real gravitational waves together, and we're empirically measuring the likelihood of the coincidence of noise. So we can measure the network SNR of all of our noise coincidences. We can do this again and again and again. We can do this for the entire observing run and really build up the strong background. So this is what you're seeing here. All right, it pains me to say it, but I think in order to get to future detectors, I may have to skip my history of LIGO and also some of my challenges. Okay, well, I'll pose it to you. Would you rather hear a really fun story about noise, or would you rather hear about tidal deformability? Because I think this is the choice before us.
Noise.
Okay. We've. What is that? Okay, tidal deformability. That sounds like a good. Yeah, you can ask me about fun noise stories over coffee. We can do that. So the reason why tidal deformability matters. So here we've got two neutron stars, they're orbiting each other, they're emitting gravitational waves, and when they get close enough, the tidal forces are going to become so strong that they start to tear each other apart. They're going to deform. And they're going to deform in such a way that's aspherically asymmetric. We can actually infer the signature of the tidal deformation that gets imprinted on the gravitational wave. This is also a beautiful kilonova simulation. I'm sorry to the multi-messenger person, I won't spend too much time talking about. So tidal deformability and constraining the neutron star equation of state, we actually have made a measurement with gravitational waves from this 2017 neutron star merger that has put really interesting constraints on the neutron star equation of state. So when I say tidal deformability, so the leading order effect, which again is a small fraction of the SNR of the signal. This is a very low SNR effect. We need a strong signal fidelity in order to be able to see it at all, which is why we only have one measurement of it, even though we have multiple neutron star mergers. So it's this lambda term. It's directly proportional to this Love number, which we'll get to in a moment, as well as the radius over the mass of the star. So what you're seeing here, so these are probability distributions for the tidal deformability of each one of the two neutron stars. And what we've done is to, so this is the 90% credible interval here. We've excluded some of these less compact models for the neutron star equation of state. So this is with just one measurement, we're starting to learn now about the interior of neutron stars. And the difference between these two plots here, this is related to what we said before about spin. If we constrain the spin of the neutron stars to be consistent with our galactic pulsars that we can see, so we get a stronger measurement. When we let them spin all the way up to nearly maximal spin, we have a little bit less strong of a constraint. So the Love number here, so this is incorporating both the fluid dynamics of some kind of a planetary body and the geometry of its shape. So they have, they're dimensionless, they tend to have values that are around 0.2 to 0.3, that tend to follow this 1 over mass shape. So the lower, this Love number K2. So this is related essentially to the density of that neutron star, which again is going to scale with its mass. The higher mass a star, the smaller it is, counterintuitively. So I wanted to say a lot more about this, but then I found this really wonderful overview of both tidal deformability and Love numbers by Katerina Cecianu. So I recommend you jot down, all of the tidal deformability fans out there can jot down this archive number, and it's a really, really nice paper that I highly recommend. And I think that's probably all the time we should take from coffee. So I'm happy to chat with you if you want to hear any fun noise stories. We'll see you in a little bit over 15 minutes.